Okay, it's Cameron and Bob. We haven't been recorded in years, three or four years.
That's correct.
Cameron's still living where he was 4 years ago?
Yes, sir, Southern California.
All right, and I'm still in Maui, and I'm going to bring up your email to me. Let's see. Chemistry and meteorology. Okay, then the second point. We have a joke here from Cameron. Interview with Marsh McLuhan, L'Express, February 1972. That's in Paris, I guess. McLuhan says, "This is what we have reached. Most people have a dog just to remind themselves of who they are. This is why dogs are so important in our society. I know who I am because my doggie recognizes me. It is the guardian of my secret. It knows my smell. He ultimately guarantees my identity. In today's world, it is the dog that controls everything. It is the dog that controls everything." Okay. Cameron trying to brighten up my day on October 15th. Oh, yes, we didn't give the date. This is October. For me, it's October 20th, but for Cameron, it's October 21st. I'm 3 hours behind Cameron. Okay, so you say, questions I'd like to discuss. You mind me saying the questions?
No, not at all. Of course.
Okay.
Not.
Number one, how does the dram of cognition relate, in your view, to the electric age? How do you fit them together? Okay, then you say, how does any age envelop? That's a different topic. Okay, dram of cognition. One of my favorite phrases from McLuhan. You'll see him talk about it around page 32 in Interior Landscape for a couple of pages mixed in there. The dram of cognition. I think he once said, language is the recognition of the dram of cognition, or maybe he said language is the dram of cognition. Does that sound familiar to you?
Not entirely, but I can imagine him saying that language is the expression of the drama of cognition.
Okay. So the drama of cognition, don't think of it as what you see or what you hear. It's your whole body in action, and you're making and matching. And McLuhan has all kinds of dialectics, but we'll take making and matching is what you're doing every day, with tactility interplaying them. And if you focus on the drama of cognition, not like on perfect inputs of sight and sound and movement, but the drama, that would emphasize the tactility. And the electric age is nothing but extended tactility. Drama of cognition would be an ongoing process. I think that is maybe best expressed in Finnegan's Wake, because it includes the drama of cognition of our senses, between the sexes, between classes, of privilege in that, or what else, between media. All dramas are in Finnegan's Wake. It's like oxygen. The drama of cognition, in a way, has no content. You can make particulars depending on what culture you do, but it's an all-purpose word like tactility. I don't know if that's the way you say it. All-purpose. Well, it indicates the core of making purposes. So
I agree with everything you're saying there.
All right. So why did this question come to you? What are you thinking?
Because the everything that you were just speaking about takes place seemingly in the individual, right? Whereas the electric age is collective. And my question is, if the drama of cognition is individual, then how does it relate to the collective? And if the drama of cognition is not individual, then how does it take place in individuals that are not subject to media influence? like somebody sitting on an island somewhere with no TV in the electric age, are they caught up in the electric age or are they not? So there's a whole bunch of questions in my mind that have to do with the individual drama of cognition and the collective fact of something like the electric age.
Okay, that's good. I have a quote, Barry Nevitt, must be an ABC of Prophecy, 1980. He talks about the interplay of cliché to archetype as the generator of consciousness. He quotes McLuhan saying that. So the interplay of cliché to archetype in that case would be the drama of cognition. So the question is, when do machines come alive or become conscious? I think we're seeing the, my term end or meme refers to technology coming alive, and that means a certain interactivity or drama cognition has happened between, well, at least in the digital age, that would be what people understand, and that new movie documentary, The Social Dilemma, is popularizing, you know, the possibility of consciousness or some autonomy going on in our digital world. There's a quote in Playboy and a quote in War and Peace in the Global Village, 69, and Playboy, 68, but I think the Playboy interview was probably done in late 68. So that year, Marshall was pointing out, the only guy in the world, I think, was saying it, that electric environments were live and organic. He said they were alive. Do you know those quotes?
I don't know that I would be able to recall them individually, but what you're saying is familiar to me and interesting in this context.
Yes, the question of somehow the drama of cognition moves into the interaction of electric organic machines. You know, for me, you know, I think of what is consciousness? Well, I got a memory, I can think up things, but a lot of what the human does in their daily, normal, mundane thinking is done by computers. The only thing is, I think people say, well, when I can fuck a computer, that would be something. Right?
Well, yeah, I think there's a certain amount of that going on now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot. Yes, I'm not up on that. But yes, there's been rumors. But the that was the old marker. You know, if you can't, if it doesn't really give you full body contact, it's not human, it's not conscious. But step it back to the way thought is used in our society, it's all done by machines. So they're equal to us in making things and engaging. So they're doing the drama of cognition on a mundane level,
yeah,
like humans do, mundane.
Yeah, what I find interesting in what you're saying and what I really hadn't thought about before is that machines in developing consciousness have become mirrors back to humans of what they were doing all along but didn't know they were doing.
Yes.
So memory storage and having access to different programs and different applications is something that humans have always done and was necessary for humans to speak language in the first place. But for hundreds of thousands of years, there was no idea about what was actually going on.
Unless you were a guru, like a Krishnamurti, who constantly talked about the drama of cognition as something you observed, the processes of making thought and memory. That's part of the esoteric world of spiritual quest. I think of that. But carry on.
No, I think what you said there is also interesting. It's not the case that people like McLuhan were somehow outthinking people like Plato. It's just that Plato didn't have the imagery and didn't have the context and media to grasp what it was that he wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
And so McLuhan talks all the time about Plato and Aristotle not reflecting on their media, and it never really occurred to me before just now that what he was speaking about wasn't concrete media, but the mirroring back to humans that's necessary for them at last to recognize what's going on.
Yeah, and in from Cliched Archetype, around page 161, he talks about the mirror is like the mind, capable of recycling all experience. Some kind of sentence like that. If you have Cliched Archetype, you could look it up right there.
Yeah.
Do you know that sentence?
That relates. Yeah, well, for sure. And that relates to Alice and all of McLuhan's references to the need to be situated behind the looking glass.
Okay, so I always thought the title 1943 about of the essay Analogical Mirrors, that means there's a mirror process in each sense. Like he used to say, each sense had a rationality. So analogical mirrors, because it's made plural, I think he went beyond the normal idea of a mirror as visual. I mean,
oh, yes. You know I love plurals, Bob.
You like what?
Plurals.
Okay, good. The echo is a sound mirror.
Yeah.
Does that work? And what would be a touch mirror, a kinetic mirror? I don't know.
Cognition itself.
Okay. Yeah, movement, proprioception. So,
music, play, all of those.
Right. So I thought it was always original. No one ever said ever put mirror into mirrors and said analogical in front of them. That's equal to global village. Analogical mirrors. It's a good phrase.
Yeah, that's an important essay. I've got a couple of posts on that at the blog.
Yeah. No, it's really good and it's important. Let's see. So have we solved the collectivity question?
Well, I don't know if we've solved it, but you introduced some interesting considerations, and I'll have to give that some thought. I mean, my question ends, how do you fit them together? And what you suggested is different ways of thinking about the question that suggests their various fittings.
Okay, here's a thought. The word makes a market, said McLuhan around 1972, or maybe it was that essay in 74, a New York Times op-ed, but the word makes a market, so every day people get their global hologram distilled into some theme, meme, or incident, and that's a phrase or a sentence. So that's the word that makes the market. So the interaction of all the other media responding to the word that makes the market, that, so they take their particular craft and spin it into movies, records, newspapers, whatever. And I always see the White House as the word that makes the market. They determine what finally is the facts, supposedly. They tell you whether the UFOs landed or not. So the word making the market is the collective dram of cognition. That certainly is.
Yep.
And the whole world participates in it. And this is what Finning's Wake really shows beautifully. All the languages, all the people and cultures of the world making something in this pot, you know, on every page of the Wake, he is acting out the drama of cognition or writing about it. And all the time I keep remembering that McLuhan spent his life translating Finnegan's Wake. And you're not going to translate it by going into the semantic meanings of each little bunch of syllables. Roland McHugh's annotations does that. He takes the top three scholars' interpretations of a few words on a page. So then you can go see all the semantic interpretation of possibilities. So you wouldn't translate all that. That's pretty tedious. So what you would do is start talking about form, the form of language versus the form of books and all that. And that's what Joyce does. He's actually, McLuhan came up with a way to translate Finnegan's Wake. Now, it's also about society and beyond the book, but it's incredible that all his writings are sentences justifying Finnegan's Wake and the way it's done.
So you mean when you say all of his writings, you mean after a certain date, right? I don't think that he even read Finnegan's Wake before the late 1940s, and when he did, he wasn't very happy with it. And then through talks, especially with Hugh Kenner, he came to appreciate it more. And by, I don't know, 1951 or something like that, he was doing what you're talking about, translating Joyce's insights into something that people could chew on.
Okay, so in Marchand's book, he says, Bernard Muller Tim, I guess in St. Louis, when the book came out in 39, they got a copy and they went to a bar. Do you remember that? And they were looking through it for the first time together. So he did start looking at it in 39. He certainly didn't write about it much, but he did in his PhD end with Joyce. Now, he could have been talking about Ulysses. I think Kenner says that he only talked about Ulysses with McLuhan. It's Don Thiel. When Thiel comes in 1950 and they start doing a Finnegan's Wake reading group, Don probably names them somewhere, the people in it, and that's 50 into 51, and they made a lot of breakthroughs, but that would agree with you that he was into the Finnegan's Wake by 51, and he right. says and he says in 53 in, what is it, James Joyce Trivial and Quadrivial, that Finnegan's Wake is about media as art forms, which is an incredible statement. Nobody used the word media. They wouldn't even know what he was referring to, the average person, unless they were in advertising or something. And then to say they're art forms, what the heck is that? But he knew. He really cracked it pretty quickly on a general understanding that, okay, this has got many media. And you brought up Murray Schafer. Murray told me, and he was in his class in 51, 52 or so, that Marshall insisted to them to understand that Finnegan's Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. He was saying that in 51, 52. That's incredible. You look at the nothing work done by other Joyce scholars, you know, just regular routine attempts to find a story or the narrative, you know, like, what's his name, Joseph Campbell's book came out in 44. What a leap he did. And I talked to Joyce, or something pretending it was James Joyce, through the Evergreens, channeled by Michael Blake Reed back in 95, and it's an excellent conversation. But he said that of the scholars that he could observe, you know, from wherever he was, he preferred McLuhan because he said McLuhan didn't project a theory or ideology or anything into it. He looked at the book in its own terms, which is the phrase McLuhan used to say about looking at media, look at them in their own terms. So Joyce appreciated that. So McLuhan really was a genius in his approach to Finnegan's Wake. You know, that was really quite an intellectual act that he did. That mm-hmm. created a dram of cognition for him because he had to deal with people who had no clue what insight he got from it. And in 54, he does that, you know, Catholic humanism and modern letters speech. That says incredible things about Finnegan's Wake. You know, what an inspiriting vision of collective something, you know, I can't remember the words, but he really raves about Finnegan's Wake in 54.
Yeah, I think that whole decade, I think he was trying to chew and find himself in relation to Joyce.
Yes.
He
writes in the late 40s, I think Andrew Crystal found this in the archives, he writes, I think, to Kenner saying, you know, I've been doing Eliot, but I'm going to focus on Wyndham Lewis now. Lewis, it's risky, he says. Risky to talk about Lewis. This is in 48, 49, but I'm now going to focus on him. Well, he actually doesn't in terms of what he does, and doesn't he do the poetic process in Aquinas and the poetic process in 50, 51, and he moves into Joyce, you know. He kind of, he doesn't write about Lewis, but he does write a great essay in 53 on Lewis, same year he does Finnegan's Wake. But he, maybe Don Thiel got him more into Finnegan's Wake. And, you know, Don, Marshall was mad at him because he didn't include Wyndham Lewis in his PhD on communication theories of Pound, Eliot, Yeats, and Joyce. And Don said that he couldn't do Lewis because his paintings were locked up at the National Archives in Ottawa. And he felt you couldn't do justice to Lewis unless you had access to his painting. So Marshall wanted him to do Lewis because, in a way, Lewis was what he was in favor of more than Joyce. But that can then lead into endless
discussion. Well, he has a letter to Lewis. I think it's in 1954.
Yeah, when the book comes out. He gets back in touch when the novel comes out in 54, Self-Condemned.
Yeah, well, the reason that he had a flurry of letters in 53, 54 to Lewis, and the reason I think that he did it was that he wrote the Art and Communication essay in Shenandoah.
Yeah.
So, but he says in one of those letters that he has changed his idea of what Lewis is about. And I think what happened around that time is that he came to the idea that although Lewis was prescient about electronic media and the influence they have on cosmic man, that Lewis did not understand the problems of how to situate humans in space and time, that he simply took over a notion of space and time from the Gutenberg era and took the opposite side from what he took the moderns to be doing. And for McLuhan, taking the opposite side is already a sign of thoughtlessness.
Thoughtlessness. Is that what you said?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, so what is it? You think he was influenced by Joyce in coming to that reassessment?
Sure, absolutely. But I don't think that in the 1950s, I don't think that McLuhan really came to any judgments or conclusions. I think everything was up in the air. And one of the interesting things about McLuhan is he always talks about, oh, I never had any problems. I never had any needs. I've always been happy as hell. But then he'll write an essay like his Prospect essay in 62 that you're familiar with.
Yes.
And he talks about how it's inevitable that you panic in front of the challenges of modern times, and these things, if you looked at them directly, would certainly drive you mad. And I think he's talking about himself for the whole decade of the 1950s.
Yes, he, you know, Clinton is seeing the stuff we haven't had access to, Marshall's writings in the 40s. And boy, talk about an apparently angry guy. He was bothered in the 40s by society, according to Clinton and some of the stuff he's quoted to me. He's, beg your pardon?
But yeah, I think I've heard some of the stuff that he's talking about. But personally, I don't find it all that surprising. I think that anybody who's familiar with his published writings in the 1940s is not going to be too surprised with the stuff that was kind of mechanical bride in progress.
Yes. Okay, so what's interesting, in 57, he does Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations, Explorations number 8, and there's a section, a part 2 section with essays by bunch of his arty friends. I think they were teachers of art and stuff like that. But he has one on Lewis called Third Program in the Human Age. And he says, it's only a few pages, but I think it's on the last page, he says, Lewis is the first writer or person to deal with the media en bloc, ENBLOC. Well, I would think that Joyce did media en bloc. when if he did media as art forms, and as Marshall writes in 53. So you may be right to say that Lewis is where he started to get, started to look at the electric age through Lewis. That would be, if he says he was the first writer to do media en bloc, doesn't mean he understood it the way Joyce did, or Joyce attempted to understand it, you know, differently. So anyways, I think it's pretty interesting how he comes back to Lewis and emphasizes him in that little essay or little article.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. The words en bloc there are very interesting. I'll have to look at that again. But what he may be saying there is that the writings of Lewis in the 20s, that their media are already being contrasted, the book as against radio, and how the arts at the time were trying to deal with this. So his notion may be that Lewis, more or less behind his own back, was identifying the central themes that we need to think about. And noteworthy in this context is that McLuhan, his whole life long, always was very thankful to Lewis for, I think, illuminating the relationship between electronic media and modern history.
Yeah. No, yes. I mean, look what he says about the art of being ruled. He said it to Innes, you know, in 1951, that it was a monumental achievement that got us out of the muck of Machiavelli's The Prince, and
yeah,
was trying to show the human shape in technology, you know, this gargantuan, huge stuff that was coming out in the 19th century. He wanted to put a human scale to it, which is quite an achievement. How do you do that? You know, for most people, it's big armies, big everything in the first half of the 20th century. I don't know if I can say how Lewis did that. You know, put the human shape in media? I'm not sure. Marshall did it, but I don't know about it in Lewis. But I haven't read Lewis in a few years, so maybe if I went back to it, I'd find something. But do you have an idea on that? How did he put the
human shape? Well, I would simply say that this is getting towards some of the questions that you were addressing earlier about the interplay between the drama of cognition, which traditionally was thought to be individual, but becomes in the 20th century something that's recognized as more than individual. And it gets recognized in primarily in the sciences, where it's simply used. And so then the question becomes, well, if it's being used and used in ways that are extremely harmful to civilization and to individual rights and identity, how are we to try to combat that? And combating that unthoughtful influence might be called humanizing.
Combating the unthoughtful somnambulism. Okay.
Yeah, but it's active.
Yes.
I mean, in cybernetics and in the use of the drama of cognition in computers and in especially in military equipment is it's more than sleepwalking. It's actively aggressive sleepwalking, which is scary stuff, and it's going on as we speak.
I was just thinking about the phrase drama of cognition, such a great phrase, and that implies something alive, the drama of cognition. I guess the mechanists, they see cognition as materialistic or sensory stimulus response stuff. They might have missed out on the drama of it, which is the province maybe of the poet, and that's why the engineers, on the cliche stereotype level, are the nerds. They don't pick up on the alive drama that electric media was getting closer to. But it's a great phrase, the drama of cognition. Yeah. Who thinks of the act of seeing as a drama?
Correct. Well, certainly Plato did, and Aristotle. I mean, it's the great minds have always understood the problem, because when they went to try to teach what they were thinking about, they ran up against some kind of wall.
Yeah.
And so then they had to try to figure out, well, how do I deal with that wall? And dealing with that wall is involves the drama of cognition.
Yeah, I'm looking up something. I did an article called The Cloning of ESP. And I just remembered this might be what I was trying to say. Okay, I'm just going to try to bring it up here in my website. Let's see. Cloning of ESP. What you just said reminded me of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've read your essay, but not for years.
Okay, so I start off saying, there's no problem understanding another if we speak the same verbal language. It's what my next move is going to be, whether verbal, gestural, or indifferent, that is of interest to the other who just spoke to me. And therein is the drama, .. of cognition. I forgot that I started the essay with this. For both of us, that's what I have, next sentence, for both of us, because I have to expect a response to my response from the other. Okay, and therein is the drama of cognition. And then I'm saying it's a drama for both of us because I have to expect a response to my response from the other. Even if we don't – but let me just finish this point.
That's fine.
Yeah. Even if we don't speak the same language, there will still be this drama of response. And my response may satisfy what the other's foreign words requested. Later, circumstances unfold that reveal a problem in what we thought we communicated. In either case – in retrospect, we will wonder how the previous exchange failed to declare the unforeseen problem. This is the first rhythm of consciousness, of thought, of memory, of the subliminal, of the consequences of extrasensory perception. This is the drama enacted in the Mutton Jute section of Finnegan's Wake, pages 16 to 18, the first dialogue in the book, and I have book in quotes. Then shortly after, James Joyce writes, on page 18, in the ignorance that implies impression, that knits knowledge, that finds the name form, that whets the wits, that convey contacts, that sweetens sensation, that drives desire, that adheres to attachment, that dogs death, that bitches birth, that entails the ensuance of existentiality. How's that for the drama of cognition? And then I go, the implied impression, yeah, in the ignorance that implies impression, that's the first six words. I then say, the implied impression is ESP, is it not? And the ignorance, in the ignorance that implies impression, is the assumption that a connection has been made. The next 10 clauses or stages are the automatic archetypal consequences of this environment of perception. All of subsequent cultural production and residue proceeds from that original drama, .. of cognition, however rudimentary the utterance. So, is that comprehensive enough?
Yes, but I would raise a couple problems. First, just an observation. What you're talking about throughout there is what McLuhan calls making.
Yes.
Right? You have to make something out. I have to make something of what you are saying. Right. So from the very first word of the very first language that was ever spoken by humans, there was a making going on.
Yes.
Then the other thing that I think we need to think about is at the very start you said if we're speaking the same language, there's no problem in understanding one another. But, of course, that's not true at all. And the difficulty of understanding the other person gets heightened when we're trying to teach something. Right.
Yes.
If the other person not only has to make out what we're saying, but has to make or recognize what's going on in their own head, then that drama of cognition becomes very involuted and very difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, maybe this is not a good sentence. There's no problem understanding another if we speak the same verbal language. But that's a vague understanding.
Right.
It's what my next move is going to be. Okay, so then as you interact with somebody, then it gets more focused, and the vagueness then becomes important, whether it's vague or not. And that's the drama. So I would say the first sentence is the vagueness, but then the subsequent sentences are about it getting more problematic about
right.
what's happening. So you see, the drama of cognition is really important. It's the archetype, and Joyce starts with that on page 16,
yeah.
the Mutt and Jute dialogue.
Right, and what I like about what you're suggesting, Bob, is that it's not correct, or it's not interesting, put it that way, to think about the drama of cognition as happening within people or within machines. Or even between people or between people and machines. Instead, you have to start with a drama of cognition and then ask, on the basis of that, what is a person, what is a machine?
Right. The drama, if you understand what we're saying about if one understands about the drama of cognition, it's easy then to see what writing in books did. You know, it moved it into a matching chance, a matching opportunity. And before that, nobody had any reference point. And this is what Julian James was trying to get at, but he didn't talk about it in media terms. I think he just talked about brain chemistry or something. But the incredible hallucination and maybe access to other kinds of consciousness, not just hallucination. So my friend Ion says that the fall of man was the printed book. We got too caught up in the matching. And, praise reality for creating the electric quantum leap into rebalancing with making. So the drama now really is, McLuhan has that quote, great quote, in the 20th century we have access to all kinds of cultures and we can appreciate the genius of each culture, in several levels of context I guess, but he says we recognize the claims each culture makes for itself, for its bias or preference or genius. But reconciling that to move to a new kind of consensus or even to tolerate the endless boasting and revenge for the boasting you don't like, what a drama that is. So that sentence,
right.
that sentence is a really good one about the drama we got ourselves into, recognizing mm-hmm. the claims of everybody, yet we're in this tactile electric extension that no culture really ever had to deal with. So there's a new drama of what's going on beyond any cultural wisdom reservoir.
Well, I don't know that I would say that last phrase. the reservoir possibility makes possible the electric age as it does any other. But in what you said before, you were certainly right. What happens in the electric age is that we become conscious of the claims of all ages.
Yes.
And there's great potential in that for wisdom and for harmony. But at the same time, basis of those kinds of insights, let's say in psychology or anthropology or literature, let's say, at the same time, the basis of those insights is being transplanted into the economy and into warfare. And so you have great possibility on the one hand, and on the other, great danger.
Yeah.
And what I see McLuhan trying to do is figure out a way to bring those together in such a way as to ameliorate the danger.
Yeah, Finnegan's Wake is a Tower of Babel on the content level, and then he translates the wake, whether Joyce meant it or not, he translates the wake into a new kind of multi-sensory Esperanto, which is quite an achievement. I mean, he's saying we can use the Finnegan's Wake as a as an Esperanto if you translate on the level of forms. Then he recognized that, you know, he had recognized that jazz united the world on the content world of radio and Louis Armstrong, but the tactility of the global theater, which is all the massive environments in the 50s, 60s, and 70s having a drama among themselves, and he said, let's find a city. We need to get a city to organize these spaces of the global village. And so the city was, you know, his big plan in the mid-60s to use the computer to measure the sensory thresholds of populations. What a great performance, which is really a question to people. Okay, I'm going to do this. And they'll say, yeah, that's crazy. You can't impose your sensory threshold computer nonsense on my culture. That's fascism. But I think that was the greatest question in philosophy, at least the 20th century, him acting it out. I'm going to do this. We have the means through computers to modulate all these claims and differences and preferences and biases, you know. What an amazing idea. And then he actually tried to do it, and Daniel Capon and them, they blew it. They, according to the Marchand's biography, they made mistakes. He never had an opportunity to do it again. But then we're now in a world where Facebook kind of does that, right? Facebook or Google or something, this social media is the orchestrator of consciousness that McLuhan was thinking more in analog media. We could say that digital media obsolesced his plan, but then it came back to Facebook. I wonder if anybody's ever said that. I call it tetrad management.
Yeah, but this becomes subject to exactly the promise versus danger dialectic that we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Right? Consciousness certainly is organized in a certain way by Facebook and Twitter and such things, but it's doing so ever more dangerously.
Yeah. They really need a crash course on McLuhan. I think one of the daughters of Eric is married to an employee of Facebook or Google. That guy should get in there. I think he's known. I think he's talked about
McLuhan. Yeah, I tried to get in touch with him. I can't quite remember which company, but he lives in Menlo Park, I think.
Yeah.
And he certainly is high enough up that he could raise some interesting questions.
Yes.
But he just doesn't seem interested in doing so. I think I even wrote him twice, but he didn't write back at all.
That's too bad. Have you tried Andrew, who could then get in touch with Emily?
Well, that's an idea. It was years ago when I tried to get in touch with this guy before I knew anything about Andrew at all.
I see, yeah. Okay, so let's go on to your next point. How does any age envelop everybody? How does it penetrate so broadly so that super accurate predictions may be made? Well, you mean by an age a medium? How does a medium envelop everybody? How does the medium penetrate so broadly so that
What I meant was the electric age. You see, what prompted these questions was our previous conversation where we were each saying, well, you're not paying attention to ground. Right? You were saying that to me, and I was saying that to you. So then when I thought about this, I thought, well, what Bob is talking about is very interesting and is certainly true about McLuhan, but there are things about what he's saying that I really don't understand. And so instead of trying to contradict you, as I may have done in the past, what I wanted to do was sort of think through where my confusions or ignorance lay. So all of these questions have to do with what the relationship is between a medium that comes to that explodes on the world and then creates the conditions for prediction that are very powerful, right? And yet it doesn't have anything to do with individuals. It happens to everybody, regardless of their training, regardless of their location. So then the question I have is, well, how is this happening? It seems to me that if we want to ameliorate the danger of how these things happen, we have to understand how it is unfolding, how the collective process is working.
Yeah, now let me read your great email to me. October 14th, you said, it has dawned on me. Now, did you were thinking about me because you re-listened to our interview, our dialogue before?
Yeah. I listened a couple months ago to it, and then the questions kind of percolated around in my brain.
Yeah, because I had just been saying to someone a week or so ago that Cameron and I don't talk. We respect each other's knowledge, but there is an impasse. We are actually quite different in what we're emphasizing. So I said I don't engage Cameron much on, say, attempting to match. But then all this email shows up, which is really good. You say, it has dawned on me that when I do chemistry, you do meteorology. And I always tell everybody when I met you with Mark Stallman in 98 at his loft in New York City, you went on about this nutty idea about chemistry. It was a radical change. And then, you know, through the years, as I've read your blog, I get the chemistry point. But I didn't know what you were on about, really, in 98. I know more about science now because of our products. But back then, I was weak on science. So maybe, you know, I didn't even know enough to understand your point. Did you want to say something?
No. I was just agreeing with you.
Okay. You were agreeing that I didn't know anything about chemistry.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
But, tell me, I was just looking up October 14th, and I didn't see anything. What's the email you're talking about?
Yeah, we should talk.
That's the subject?
Yeah, you sent to me, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you say...
Yeah.
What? You got it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so then you start off with a quote from the Hot and Cool Gerald Stern interview of McLuhan. You say, or McLuhan is saying, and the massage, the shaping, the twisting, the bending of the whole human environment by the technology, the reconditioning of the entire human environment by this technology is a violent process, and like all new technologies, often revolting as well as revolutionary. That is why Joyce calls them thunders. So you say that. Then you say, when the weather gets intense enough, the chemist sitting in his lab gets swept away along with everybody else. He is a tiny figure on an overpowering ground. You are right. You're addressing me. You are right that this is a sizable part of McLuhan's massage. Then you say, but if everyone were swept away in the same way, how could there be recognition and possible survival? How could there be the mariner brother who is saved? Within the whirlpool, there are some who evaluate the possibilities at hand. Within the whirlpool, world, WORLDPOOL. So within the whirlpool, there are some who evaluate the possibilities at hand. These possibilities are the elements of human consciousness. The chemistry of human consciousness is the demonstration and application of these elements. It is ground to all the figures of human perception, including those of meteorology. This is another sizable part of McLuhan's massage. We should dialogue on the resonance of chemistry and meteorology. Now, the way I answered your dram of cognition question is dealing with this. I talked about the biological or psychological process of making consciousness, and then I said it was in the machine. So I went from chemistry to meteorology, right?
No, I would say that what you did was you resituated the question of consciousness from individual people to beings in general. And that you then said that difficulties can be encountered if you try to think of drama of cognition located only within people. Instead, it's much more broad than people, and that you need to think of, instead of thinking of the drama of cognition through people, you have to think of people through the drama of cognition, and the same thing applies to machines. So that jump is not the jump from chemistry to meteorology. What that is the resituating of the question of chemistry more broadly than what I was doing. So I take your point, and I'm grateful for it. Meteorology, in my sense, is the vast changes of media environment that happen in history. And I'm really interested in the question of the relationship between these vast changes and the drama of cognition, however it's conceived in regard to people and machines.
Okay, so Nelson Thal once, just blatantly, when I first met him in 83, 84, and we shared McLuhan, so he found someone that, was interesting to talk to about it. I knew a lot about the writings of McLuhan more than anybody he had met before, and he had pretty good knowledge of it. So he says, so what did McLuhan mean by the medium is the message? And I said this, the incarnation mimed the stages of apprehension, something like that. And that would be the drama of cognition. So the capital I of incarnation, so Christ, the incarnation mimed the drama of cognition. That blew him away, because he was Jewish, but he was just starting to study and become a Catholic, under the influence of McLuhan. And he had an identity crisis when McLuhan died, and a kind of a breakdown. And then remaking himself, he became a Catholic. So I said this Catholic thing, not knowing that about him at the time. And, it was an amazing punch to his brain. Wow. So I think of that, and I think I got that idea from the Catholic Humanism of Modern Letters, the 54 thing, 1954. So then I looked at understanding media. Okay, media, hot and cool. There's the obvious weather aspect. But there's a comment on weathermen in Understanding Media, I think it is. The weathermen, and, people are watching TV news in the 50s and 60s, the evening local news, and they always had the weatherman was always a local character. So the weatherman was doing pattern recognition. It's almost phatic communication. So McLuhan was a weatherman. And so he was miming that role in the community by calling media hot and cool or hot and cold. So there was that part. So I thought it was neat that you brought up the meteorology thing, because I always thought about that. If you get a chance, if you can search, look what he says about weathermen in Understanding Media. It's an interesting role. It's almost like phatic communication because he can't – you see, the whole thing about news is they're warning people about what's coming, but you can't panic the people, right? You can't take it can't.
Well, weren't the weathermen a terrorist group too?
Yes. The SDS guys, 6970, became weathermen. I don't know. Did they get that from a Dylan song or something? I don't remember. I don't remember where they got the term from.
Wouldn't surprise me if that were the case.
Yeah. So, okay, so meteorology is great, but what I was saying to you at the beginning is there's, you know, Ernst, some name like that, in the 19th century, you know, ontology recapitulates phylogeny. Remember that sentence?
Yeah. I can't remember the guy's name either. He definitely was a German, and he was a materialist. But anyway, I know what you're talking about, and I use that phrase sometimes myself.
Right. So there you have the parallel tracks of the individual growth and the society growth. So now you're saying chemistry is private consciousness?
No, chemistry is the study and application of the elements of consciousness. Chemistry in my sense.
Yeah.
Study and application of the elements of consciousness. So let me just go back a little ways. You started off talking about an encounter you had with Don Thiel.
Yes.
And you said that your very first part of that was that the medium is the message. And then you, at least in my understanding, you didn't really come back to that same thought. You went from medium as the message to the 1954 St. Joseph's lecture. And you said that the incarnation was the replay of the drama of cognition.
Yeah.
And but I think that the incarnation is not the replay of the drama of cognition. The drama of cognition is the replay of incarnation.
Yes.
Right? That's an important difference between the two, because the incarnation gives a kind of ontological basis to the drama of cognition.
Yeah, now he also, the other mystery he used to talk about was the fact that our individual consciousness through the eye flipped the world. And I've thought about that in different ways, like the basic stubbornness of the individual.
Are you using I in the sense
of EYE?
EYE, okay.
Yeah, do you know, he talks about no one could explain, he said, why through the, you know, at the back of the eye and the retina, it flips the world upside down.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the first act of making, of altering the world. He also said that you couldn't know anything outside in the world, but maybe he meant artifacts, but you couldn't know things out there unless they were part of you. You remember him saying that?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, that's a very Aristotelian, Thomistic idea.
All right, yeah. Okay, so a metaphor of the flipping of the world, the individual as their own sovereign making ability are going to mess with the world. So they flip it. So our psychological process of establishing our sovereignty is mined physiologically by flipping the world. You know, we're going to make it ours. So I always thought that was interesting how the basic willfulness of human stubbornness and that the making, the will, is reflected in physiology.
Right. And this comes back, Bob, to the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
That you were speaking about before. It's very important in McLuhan and presumably in Joyce to understand how the Tower of Babel worked. You were bringing it into connection with Esperanto, but I believe both Joyce and McLuhan were very suspicious of Esperanto and
yes.
Volapük and all of these constructed languages.
Yeah.
The way the Tower of Babel worked is that all humans got together and decided that they were going to storm heaven on the basis of their communal understanding, their communal wisdom, their communal abilities. And so they began putting the tower together. And then God said, well, to hell with this, and scattered not only the tower, but all of the peoples of the earth into separate ignorances. Right? So for Joyce and McLuhan both, the attempt to establish a common language is associated with exactly what you were talking about now, this reign of the I.
Yes.
This of willful assertion, right? And so for both Joyce and McLuhan, remembering our ignorance, remembering our smell, remembering our stupidity is a very important part of making.
Yes. You have something else to say? Because I thought I had a thought, but I slipped away. So we're talking about Tower of Babel or Babel. Oh, yeah. So McLuhan, on the private consciousness level, saw the world in harmony. And I think he said that Alexander Pope's Essay on Man, which ends with whatever is right. Some people, most people take
the coming of chaos,
in,
right? Universal night.
No, I don't think the poem ends with that. I know the section. It ends with whatever is right. And most people take that as satirical, ironic. But McLuhan was seeing that there was a balance among the machines, often in society, among the technologies. He would say the medieval and the Chinese societies were balanced. But, you know, the printing press had opera to balance it off. So I sometimes see McLuhan as a really up-to-date modern mega poet, is seeing the vision of harmony, that's the poetic cliche or archetype, that he was actually pointing out that there was an balance, equilibrium or something going on in society, but everybody willfully messed it up, misinterpreted it. You ever thought about his work that way?
Oh, absolutely. That's in the blog. I call that the main question. And I have a lot of posts about that. We need to look at what you're talking about there in a whole bunch of different ways.
Yeah.
For example, you're talking about balance. That's a resonance. That is a form of play. It's not something that's stable and is fixed.
Yeah, it's not visual.
It's something dynamic.
Yeah.
Right? But ultimately, for McLuhan, it's not something that is in the world or of the world. It's something that is at the foundations of the world, and that is a something divine. And as can be seen in the death of Christ on the cross, the world is not protected by this resonating balance. It's the world is exposed to extreme danger at all times, but especially after the development of electronic machines. And we're in our times following the Second World War, we're living out the drama of how all of this is going to play out. Is it going to play out into the extreme of no survival, or are we going to find the means of survival? And McLuhan certainly situated his thought in regards to survival.
Yep. Let's see. So we did, how does any age envelop everybody? How does it penetrate so broadly so that super accurate predictions may be made? Well, a medium, I was talking to someone the other day about what is, how does the society become visually biased once you have the printing press? What is where is the communication among individuals where they all start to get the same preference? Is it in the realm of mind or memes or the 100th monkey effect? It's a strange place where media effects, if they are real, if they do happen, where does it get communicated? You know, it's
right,
like, go ahead. That's what? Another
well,
great question?
That's exactly the sorts of questions I was trying to raise with you. This is the relationship between individual cognition and these vast media memes.
Is it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So is this where it's important how people look? They must look within a range of familiarity. You know, take tribes. They got to have their clothing or decorations, whatever they wear, there's a range of it. So, you know, you take, say, Native Americans with their loincloth and not much clothing, the way they were presented in movies. Then they meet a Chinaman who has this crazy hat on and square stuff. That's alienating maybe to people. That's a shock to see someone wearing a different environment. So what made the people in China sort of have this preference for that kind of costuming? Maybe it's
right.
The weather, but made the Eskimos or Inuit have a way different costume. So it always hovers between obvious practical common sense and yet a mystery part in it. So the mystery may oscillate back and forth between meteorology and chemistry, or the private individual and the collective. And that would be the drama, back to the drama of cognition again.
Right. So that's exactly the example you bring out is one that McLuhan takes from Joyce in...
Portrait?
No, before Portrait. The
Stephen Hero.
Book, yeah, exactly. Sorry. Yeah. So in, I think it's in his 1951 Joyce essay, or it could be in the 53 Joyce essay, he quotes Joyce saying that Chinaman may prefer, I forget what it
the
is.
The digestive system. But everybody has
yeah,
the same
exactly.
digestive system, right?
Yeah. And that's the drama of cognition, right?
Yes. Yes. And they have that great quote by McLuhan in the Review of Burroughs in 64, and he talks about we're all inside each other. We're all
right.
digesting each other now, electrically. Remember that part?
Yeah, yeah absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Great statement.
And so, yeah, and so that relates to this dialectic or this overpowering weather system where you have danger and potential survival wrestling with each other and creating vast weather fronts through this wrestling. I've lost my chain. Go back to what you were just talking about so I can reconnect my thoughts.
Why, how do we go from common sense and obviously people prefer people to look like each other to the mystery?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you were talking about the Burroughs review.
Digestion.
And, right. And so what has happened is that in the electric environment, as both cause and effect, we have come to understand all of the different possibilities of being human. And on the one hand, that gives us insight into supposedly primitive societies and gives us new opportunities in literature and stuff. But it also gives all sorts of new possibilities for weaponry and computers that can be used either benignly or disastrously, et cetera. So when you talk about everybody being inside and eviscerating each other, then what's going on there is that we've become conscious of the possibilities, but we don't know how to relate to them in a way that enables us to find peace, to find a balance that works. And that's, you know, goes back to the Tower of Babel again.
Yeah.
How do we get a possibility for peace that isn't the imposition of some form of human wisdom?
Yeah. Okay. Go to your second point. The problem of the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. But
yeah.
That's, is it Alexander Whitehead?
Oh, that's Alfred North.
Alfred North Whitehead. So he says...
Science in the Modern World.
Right. So he has the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. And then with McLuhan, it is the opposite of Whitehead. Whitehead saw abstractions misplaced as particulars. But with McLuhan, it's particulars misplaced as abstractions. So, for example, hearing from all sides or gaps in TV points of light. Both of these are particulars which do the work of fundamental specification. The ear which tunes into TV or is tuned by TV is not the ear that hears noises. The gaps in TV images are not the gaps between figure and ground. Well, that's a messy, mixed-up thing. Misplaced as abstractions.
What I'm going to, Bob, here is what I take to be ways of mistaking or misunderstanding McLuhan that are practically universal.
Okay.
So, for example, he'll say something about TV causes, right? Or the book did this, or the alphabet did this, right?
Yeah.
And so then people think, well, I mean, I know what a book is. I know what the alphabet is. I know what a TV is. And so McLuhan is talking about that. But no, what he is talking about what makes these things possible. And how is it possible that we can have something like an alphabet? What is required for that to be the case? Similarly with a book, similarly with TVs, right? And so there's not only a huge physical environment that's necessary for these things. There's also an internal environment that's necessary for these things. And McLuhan is always talking about these very complex presuppositions. So when he says the medium is the message, what he's talking about is the medium in these very complex ways. And it's very, very common in McLuhan, quote-unquote, scholarship, for people to mistake what he's talking about as something particular. You know, the television, the book, the alphabet, on and on.
Those are particulars, and they're abstracted?
No, well, when I use abstraction here, what I mean is that McLuhan is using these images these particulars to suggest something that is not particular. And I called that abstraction, but I know that the word abstraction is a bad word that upsets people and stuff. And I sort of used it because of that upsetting. I was trying to indicate that for McLuhan, the medium is never something particular. It's something that enables particulars. And that although McLuhan often spoke in terms of particulars, that was just because he had to use words, number one, and number two, teaching anybody anything is a dicey process.
Yeah, now, it's interesting. As you talk, I start to veer towards, we're saying the same thing, you know, Plato said with different words. Then I veer, no, there's something different going on. But that's the obvious difference. Plato didn't live in our society. Way different. So I veer back and forth. And mm-hmm. I read once, I think it was in the Whole Earth Catalog in 1970, they would review books. And so they were writing about, Stuart Brand was probably writing it and commenting on his books. And he said, humans have meaning. There's two functions in the brain, two aspects of knowing. The bigger picture, which is meaning, and focusing on particulars. So we're always juggling back and forth between meaning and particulars. Now, the bird's eye view is a literate bias. So there's a literate version of the meaning, the big view, the big picture, versus, I guess, other cultures use the ear. But, you know, it's interesting how we're a dialectic, but then other factors move it beyond the control by dialectic or those terms. And so I guess you would see that in Finnegan's Wake, the millions of dialectics all through the book, but he's scattering them. So that's going from meaning to particulars. And so you seem to be doing that here, going from particulars to abstractions. And we come back to the question of how the heck did people get on the same page of things? And you can get into, obscure esoteric psychology where effects precede causes, or people have a knowing always anyways, an interesting right. ESP going on between people, just sitting on a bus driving somewhere. There's a lot of communication going on the intangible level, the feeling level. Right?
What you're talking about here is the question of what goes on when language is first used by humans, or similarly, what goes on when a child learns language.
Yeah.
Right? They are always relating to a particular noise, but that noise is suddenly more than a noise.
Yeah. Now, do you know, are psychologists coming to a big wrapping up and understanding anything? Or do they admit there's so many new questions? Has anybody announced an ending point in our great knowledge quest?
Well, not that I know of.
Yeah.
But anyway, the ending won't be a point.
Yeah. So, okay, so then the next point, I mean, all these questions, you know, could go on for a long time, sticking to one sentence. But just to show your range here, point three, theme three, acoustic space, the audio, sometimes said to be a space in play with the visual. Does that mean a space in itself? Why do you underline that?
I go on to illustrate it.
Oh, yeah, sometimes said to be the space of spaces.
Right, so before we give the examples, the point is that McLuhan sometimes says that acoustic space is the basic environment of human beings.
And that's important to say sometimes.
Right, exactly. So he's not consistent, but what I have found with McLuhan is that oftentimes, instead of dismissing or criticizing an inconsistency, you should think about it and try and figure out why he was being inconsistent, because that's often a signpost of something to be thought about.
Yeah, the discontinuity of speech. I saw a lecture by Richard Cavell recently, and he talked about his deep appreciation of the discontinuity of acoustic space, and that's why he could accept and understood McLuhan would talk that way, would contradict or shift or abrupt or change. And then there's that interview with Tom Snyder, that New York TV talk show guy, where he says, you know, Marshall, do people ever tell you that they sometimes don't follow you? have you seen that? Does it ring a bell?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And McLuhan says, well, he quickly has an answer. He says, well, that's because they try to connect what I'm saying now with what I said before. And that's, I don't know what an average uninformed mind would think of that statement. What do you mean? Of course you have to connect what you said before and now. You can't be discontinuous. But McLuhan was pointing out, we are discontinuity more and more in our lives. And this is what Cavell was pointing out. So somehow that relates to what we were talking about. The what did you say that makes me think of this discontinuity? You said, the ground.
I was talking about how he's consistent or not.
Oh, yeah, that's it. And so he would do that. Okay, so if he wants to emphasize the acoustic gang, he does what he said to Snyder. I don't connect what I said before with what I'm saying now. But we know in his talks and essays, he does make a sequence of connections, a layout, an argument. So, yeah, the situation determines whether he's going to be discontinuous or not. And this shows where humans got in communication. You know, 200 years ago, you couldn't go around playing games like that with people. Well, they would, as they used to back in the schools of Kant's day, you know, they'd wear their swords to school, right? You get into a serious argument, you're going to have a duel about it, you might die. So we're incredibly soft today, is my discontinuous conclusion. So I didn't help you with that one, eh? I didn't get anywhere?
Well, I would say you got off on a bit of a tangent, but you're a person who likes to go off on tangents, and it's interesting to follow you when you do so.
Okay, good. All right, so what are you trying to show here? Sometimes said to be a space and play with the visual. Sometimes, then to be the space, the ground, and McLuhan does say it's sound is the ground in some cases, but not. But then he might say tactility is the ground, which would be the emptiness, yeah. Right?
Well, that's another whole example that we could get into. But why don't you read the two examples I give of him talking about the space and a space?
Okay. The first is from Laws of Media, page 77. The interval between the wheel and the axle has long served as an example not only of touch, but of play. Touches in quotes, plays in quotes. Without play, in quotes, without that figure ground interval, there's neither wheel nor axle. The space between the wheel and the axle, which defines both, is where the action is. And that's in quotes, where the action is. And this space is both audible and tactile. He's trying to describe the mind thing that I brought up at the beginning. This space between objects.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, so that's the space. Then you have
right.
from Bruce
Global
Powers.
Village.
Yeah, and McLuhan's book, The Global Village. A space. So this is page 4. The same may be said for the left and right brain. We must once again accept and harmonize the perceptual biases of both. ... The book of nature contains innumerable borderlines and interfaces. The resonant interval may be considered an invisible borderline between visual and acoustic space. You must once again accept and harmonize the perceptual biases of both. Is simple self-awareness, does this cover simple reflection on oneself? What are you doing when you're thinking about yourself? You know, the original meaning... No, the original meaning of repenting is retracing. So you retrace the events of your day before you fall asleep. Retracing is natural, and McLuhan talks about tracing and retracing on that page 32 of Interior Landscape, you know, the drama of cognition. So this thinking thing that goes on, this self-awareness, and it spreads to other people. Other people know you're doing it.
Is that a question?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. You're getting back here to the sorts of questions that I was raising earlier.
Yes. Well, everybody raised these questions all through history.
Oh, sure. I'm not claiming any originality here.
No, I'm not, but I'm being ironic or funny that our questions, anything to be taken seriously.
Absolutely. In fact, for seriousness does not exclude humor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Something can be ultra serious and ultra funny at the same time. Maybe questions are the very heart of what needs to be taken most seriously. So, for example, if at the deepest ground of human being is maybe questions about the real, questions about meaning, questions about death, and those questions are unanswerable because they're so deep. But the interesting thing about those questions is that even though they're unanswerable, they might provide foundation, right? So one way of thinking about Finnegan's Wake, where, you know, I'm completely ignorant about Finnegan's Wake compared to you and others, but I would suggest that one of the points of Finnegan's Wake is that the complete undecidability of everything is foundation.
And that's only if you're around someone who thinks they're know-it-all and are imposing their will too much. If I'm with a reasonable person who's not going to interrupt me too much, then there's a harmony, and it's natural. But then a third person comes in that upsets the balance, which is a metaphor for a new technology comes in, upsets the relationships between people. So then questions come. Mm. But
you're doing is you're making questions subsequent, secondary. But if you have a thunder in Finnegan's Wake, and the result of the thunder is to completely annihilate a way of life, that sort of questionability isn't because some moron arrived on the scene. It's because it's built into the very nature of things.
So what would you say to Donald Trump if you had a chance, a private conversation with him, and you thought that he was interested in your thinking and your possibility of giving him an angle that he hadn't thought of, that you noticed? And I'm saying Trump because he's a position in person in responsibility. He has to respond to the world more than I have to. On the collective level. So is that too out of the park about what you would say to Trump?
Well,
did you see that essay by some anonymous guy who compared Trump and McLuhan, and he had a good bunch of scattering of McLuhan quotes to illustrate it?
I know where it is. It's on the New Explorations website, I believe. But Clinton, I think, did some work with it, but I never pay any attention to stuff like that, because I always think that that's an attempt to sort of use McLuhan as opposed to trying to understand, to interrogate McLuhan.
Well, it's an interrogation, but you have standards or something.
Correct. You can't read everything.
Right. So yeah, you pick your time. I've got more time than you. I can read everything.
Oh, good.
Did you read Richard Cavell's book?
Yes.
Remediating.
I haven't read that actually. Just before COVID hit, I asked for the book through interlibrary loan.
And it didn't make it.
Then the library shut down. Yeah. So I want to read it. I must tell you, I'm not a great fan of Cavell. I don't. I think his understanding of the depths of McLuhan is off.
Yes.
He often brings Nietzsche into play, and he has a certain interpretation of Nietzsche that I don't agree with, and then to apply that to McLuhan is difficult. So,
right. So he, you know, it's called The Geography of Space or something. His book, McLuhan and Geography or something. Anyways, I read it.
Are you talking about his earlier book?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's called McLuhan and Space or something like that.
Yeah, so I read it and I called him up, and he said he spent 2 weeks in the archives, and
uh-huh.
I think in the book it comes up, or he said to me personally, but he was trying to figure out acoustic space and tactile space, and to me, in a way he doesn't get it, and
uh-huh.
So that's what I thought when I read it, and then when I talked to him and he said he spent 2 weeks. I immediately thought to myself, that's not long enough. 2 weeks?
No,
nothing.
Christ, no.
Yeah, so I think maybe that's why we're irritated by the book. He actually doesn't go as deep as he thought he did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is sort of his persona, right? That he's a deep and complicated thinker. And if you don't find his thought deep and complicated, then it's not going to be that interesting.
Right. Now, his new book, which I read, I tell Alex Kuskus that I told him for a few years that, you know, he asked me, who's a good McLuhan scholar? I say Cameron McEwen. So he says, on his own, I just saw him, he made a little blurb about whatever Cavell was doing, and he said, I consider him the top McLuhan scholar and today. And he does tackle the virtual postmodern guys. You haven't read the book, but he takes on the postmodern virtual thinkers. And he tries to make the point that, in the end, technology is us. He tries to do what McLuhan said Lewis does, puts this human shape in technology, but it's more, I don't know, philosophical abstract. So he's just stating technologies are human. There's no... not many particulars to illustrate it, other than abstract talk about post-humanism or something. So I thought it was good that someone, you know, ran McLuhan through those guys or women. But another guy, young guy, he's young, he just got his PhD. He said he thought the book was horrible. Now, I don't know much about this guy who said that, but I've got two opinions. I've got Alex Kuskus saying this guy is a top scholar, and the other guy is saying, oh, what a horrible book. I'm in between, but I'm not sure Richard has done enough reading of McLuhan. He's certainly done a lot more than 2 weeks' worth. He's put together a couple of books, collection of essays, and they're a good collection in one of them. But I think I prefer your writing than his. No, I can't even say that. You're so far apart from each other, I guess is what it is. So you're both useful.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I was curious before I called you if you had read Cavell, but you haven't. So you might want to take a look at that.
Well, sometime. I read his first book, but not Remediating.
Yeah, this is very different. Very different book. Because, you know, he's talking 60s McLuhan in the first book, and that book's like 25 years old. Now here it is 50 more years later, and you can run McLuhan by, you know, all the developments that have happened in sociological thinking or metaphysics, and that hadn't been done too much, updated of McLuhan,
mm-hmm.
updating
mm-hmm.
of him. Okay, so we got this endless, I'm just wondering about how much can one ignore one's thoughts? When do you interrupt people? When do you let them interrupt you? Carolyn just walked, just got up. She heard that sentence. Did you hear her? She laughed. Are you there?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. She laughed because she interrupted me. Okay.
I also laughed because we got a bunch of dogs running around.
A bunch of what? Dogs, did you say?
Dogs, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we should stop.
Yeah, that's fine.
But we, because I have to go somewhere in a few hours.
Uh-huh.
So definitely we need a part two. I'm not sure where we got. Your questions are great. I think it's interesting to other McLuhan scholars to hear what we say because nobody talks about McLuhan in an interesting way, it seems.
Yeah.
They just rehash, oh, yeah, this guy said this. Oh, he said that. They don't go into the whole history of thought and where he is in that. Let's see. What was... So what is your... Let's end on this point. What was the point you were telling me about chemistry? Why was it such a breakthrough in 1800? Run that by me again. You know, here we are 22 years later. Let's end with that, because that was important to you, that insight, right? And where did you
Absolutely.
Get it from? Where did you get it from?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's interesting. I know exactly where and when it occurred to me. I could go there right now.
Okay.
If I had an hour to spare and the freeways weren't too bad.
Okay, we'll do that next time.
All right.
But can you sum up what's the point?
Well, the point of what we are doing is that we're bouncing off each other ideas derived from fairly substantial readings and of McLuhan and thinking about McLuhan for many years. And at least for me, I learn stuff. And if it's interesting to anybody else, I think it's because they also learn stuff.
Yes. So what about the chemistry point?
Oh, do you want me to go into that? I'm sorry.
Not the hour long, just one sentence. Just state the significance of 1800 in human
because,
knowledge.
All right. So... humans had been dealing with physical materials for hundreds of thousands of years. And whenever they dealt with physical materials, they were doing pattern recognition. So in 1800, what happened was that there was pattern recognition of the pattern recognition. And that's the elements of chemistry. And when McLuhan says the medium is the message, he's saying that the pattern recognition of the drama of cognition needs to be subject to pattern recognition.
Uh-huh.
And if we can achieve that, then we can achieve survival.
Okay. All right. That's something good to think about. So that's great. 22 years later to have the thought that I didn't know what you were meaning back then. Certainly makes more sense now, what you said.
Okay, good.
So,
and just cook that together with what I was talking about at the same time in the mail, the mail website that was media ecology somewhere, Johns Hopkins maybe, where I was always talking about time and times.
Yeah, that was the Peter Montgomery's site that he got from George Sanderson at St. Yvette's.
Yep.
And you grew up in Winnipeg?
I didn't grow up in Winnipeg. I grew up in Regina. But
oh.
I went to high school in Winnipeg.
Why? You moved?
No, there's a boarding school in Winnipeg, and I went there.
Your parents sent you there?
Yeah.
And you wanted to go there?
I don't know. I had some good friends in Regina that went there and that were good athletes. And Ravenscourt had always had a very good hockey program. So that a few years after I was there, the Canadian national team was based there. So it wasn't like being sent to detention school or anything.
Mm. It was to enhance your skills, get to a better city, a better...
Well, it was, I guess, I don't know what my parents were thinking, but it seemed like the socially acceptable thing to do, so I went.
It was a fad in Regina. Everybody said, yeah, we got to send our boys to Winnipeg. McLuhan
Something
used
like
to be
that.
There. There must be some after residue there. And that would have been in the mid-60s? Or 70s?
No. I went there in 1958, graduated in 62. Then went
no,
to
72. Princeton.
72. No, 62.
Oh, I thought you said you went there in 68. You went there in
58? No, 58.
Oh, okay. And, right. Well, that's before the McLuhan fad, so can't blame it on McLuhan.
I never tried to blame it on McLuhan, but over the next few years after that, I remember my dad telling me sometime around 1964, maybe, that he had read a few things by McLuhan and thought that I'd be interested in it. And so then I started to read a bit of McLuhan myself.
What was he, his profession?
He was a physician.
A doctor. So he was learned or, you know, educated. And...
Nah, not really. I don't. my dad would suggest things like this, and then later I would find out that he'd never read anything of McLuhan. that he just sort of picked it out of the air and thought it might be something that I'd be interested in.
And he was right.
Yeah, absolutely. he often did stuff like that.
Okay.
He often found stuff... that was interesting to me.
Yeah, so he was not learned. He was cagey.
Ah, maybe.
Yeah.
He was a graduate of University of Manitoba, just like McLuhan.
Oh, there are characters that come out of that school, right?
That's right.
Okay. Great talking to Cameron, and we'll...
Okay,
you know,
same
in
here,
week or, and within a week or so, we'll do part two.
Good.
Talk okay,
you
thank
then.
You.
Okay, ciao, ciao. Thank you.
Bye. Yep, talk to you later.